Podcast by any means necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, and today we're going to be talking a little bit more about sustainable resistance movements in our final segment, and then also about Social Security, Medicare, some of Trump's appointments, what it's going to mean for all of those different things. But before we can move on, Donald Trump, President of the United States, has nominated Neil Gorsuch, a 49-year-old who is currently a judge on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, to the Supreme Court of the United States. Trump revealed his pick in a very showman-like way, doing it during prime time on television, walking out alone to keep the suspense high for a few minutes before announcing that he had, in fact, picked Gorsuch. And in picking Gorsuch, who many had tipped as the front-runner ahead of time, Trump has picked someone whose conservative bona fides are not in doubt, but who also has relationships with liberals in the world of jurisprudence and who is known as one of the most intellectually skilled federal judges, which has gained him wide respect generally in the legal profession. Gorsuch's judicial philosophy is allegedly that of originalism, which was the philosophy associated with the judge he was replacing, or the justice he may be replacing, Antonin Scalia. Originalism speaks to a set of ideas that believes the Constitution should be interpreted by the courts based on the founder's original meaning, and it's usually counterposed to the idea of a quote-unquote living Constitution, originally propounded by Oliver Wendell Holmes, also a Supreme Court justice, and which is at the center of liberal jurisprudence, and whose main idea is that our understanding, our being American citizens, of concepts and ideas can evolve over time, and interpretation of what is constitutional must take that into account. However, this distinction is to some degree not really that warranted, given that there's no way to even know what the founders would think about anything beyond their time. So originalist judges often are just reading their own conservative understanding of contemporary reality onto modern-day political debates and just claim, well, this is what the founders would have done. Gorsuch, however, is really not that much of an originalist to some degree. In his book on euthanasia and assisted suicide, he ruminates on the history of suicide from the point of view of Christian ethics, the founders' beliefs, and modern political and moral arguments. So interestingly enough, Gorsuch seems to have a worldview that's in the orbit of Steve Bannon, which is sort of the right-wing movement that's anchored in Judeo-Christian beliefs and a broad spectrum of Western Enlightenment-era ideals, including the primacy of market economies, which speaks directly to the two principal areas Gorsuch has ruled on that appear to be of some consequence here. In line with the idea of the importance of Christianity and religious values in general, Gorsuch is a relatively extreme defender of the rights of religious groups against the state. For instance, he was a key figure in both the Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters of the Poor Supreme Court cases that sought to prohibit the government from acquiring companies for giving access essentially to birth control and contraceptives through their healthcare plans. In the Little Sisters for the Poor case, even offering healthcare plans paid for by the government that would give someone birth control. Gorsuch authored and supported opinions in both of those cases that allow the religious beliefs of the owners of the company to then be forcibly imposed on all their employees regardless of their religious beliefs. So it also wouldn't be terribly surprising for you to know Gorsuch has also been a major supporter of limiting the regulatory authority of the government over corporations in general. In particular, Gorsuch is keen to rein in what is euphemistically known as Chevron deference. And this means that the court gives the government the benefit of the doubt in determining the meaning of laws passed by Congress that are clearly ambiguous, and Gorsuch would prefer the courts issue these clarifications. Now, many regulations fall under this. Congress will say, for instance, keep the water clean. Then the EPA has to figure out, well, what does that actually mean? Gorsuch would rather the courts decide that, which would give corporations much more power to push back on regulations and make government agencies more hesitant to issue the regulations in the first place. He's also expressed some fairly extreme views on campaign finance law, arguing that the right of someone to contribute to campaigns is one of the most fundamental rights, right up there with free speech. You know, some people consider it a form of free speech, and suggesting that he would be willing to go even further than Citizens United and allowing a free-for-all for major donors. Gorsuch has not ruled directly on abortion cases, but as mentioned above, he has written a book on assisted suicide where he came down firmly on the side of the right to life. So we can imagine where he may fall on any future case dealing with Roe v. Wade, but we can't be sure. Gorsuch was also a clerk to a current justice, Anthony Kennedy, which many people are interpreting as a sign to Kennedy from the Trump administration that it's okay for him to retire. He's 80 years old. Kennedy is often a swing vote and does not necessarily hew to any particular ideological current on the court. The thought behind Gorsuch being picked is it would make Kennedy feel that someone who is more of a jurist than an ideologue, like how he views himself, is now on the court, and thus it's safe from political manipulations in their view, and thus safe for him to retire, giving Donald Trump another Supreme Court pick, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, also pretty old, and so he could get three all told. Judges often rule in ways that people did not expect, and oftentimes judges appointed as liberals or conservatives end up not being so liberal or conservative once they get there. The Supreme Court is also highly political and almost always considers the broader political context in the country and how they make their rulings as well, especially the major ones. So while we can't make exact predictions about Gorsuch, it's clear that he's firmly in the right-wing mainstream, lines up with the things Republicans seem to care about at all levels, and has a deeper philosophical core that appears to make him someone who may be more of a part of Steve Bannon's view of the longer-term political strategy for the right wing in America and around the world that has found its center in the Trump White House. Representative Matt Gaetz from Florida's 1st Congressional District, which is right there in the panhandle, shout out Pensacola, has introduced a bill into Congress to completely eliminate the EPA. He claims he's doing it for small business. Yes, small businesses that apparently are closing down in huge numbers across the nation because of environmental regulations. Yeah, that's what he says. This lines up perfectly with the fact that Trump has sought to appoint Scott Pruitt to the head of the EPA, given that Pruitt has dedicated his career up to now to destroying the EPA, or at the very least turning it into a totally toothless entity. Also, the fact that many analysts believe Trump would essentially gut the EPA and has his eye on eliminating $800 billion in crucial funding right away. Seems somewhat unlikely this bill will succeed, but it is another in a long list of signs that the EPA is going to have some trouble making it through the Trump administration as much more than a name in an office. You know how various Klan and Nazi types support Donald Trump? How notorious KKK leader David Duke endorsed and did a robocall for him? Of course you do. So that means you may be wondering, well, how do these crazy racists think Trump is doing so far? Well, thankfully, the good people at Huffington Post took a dive into the message boards and internet chat rooms a lot of these people hang out in to try to find out. Here's some of what they found. One of the top posts yesterday on the alt-right Reddit page approvingly noted that Trump, quote, calls out communist Jew Chuck Schumer for his fake tears when shilling for the Islamic invasion, exclamation point, close quote. And in another highly popular Reddit post, someone stated with glee, and of course many people were agreeing with this, that they thought Trump was going to go, quote unquote, full fash. That's slang for full fascist. Stormfront, the most popular Nazi website, was filled with people very excited about the border wall that Trump is going to build and enthusiastically suggesting other ideas for border policy. One user with the handle Aryan Warrior, I can only imagine his deeper political beliefs, stated, quote, I too like the idea of a minefield, end quote. So 10 days in and the verdict from Nazis and Klansmen are clear. Trump is doing great so far. And finally today, Robert Speer, who is the acting secretary of the United States Army, has ordered the Army Corps of Engineers to proceed with the Dakota Access Pipeline project. It isn't clear, actually, how much of the way is now cleared for the project with this decision, and opponents of the pipeline are arguing that they still can't go forward because the results of the environmental impact study ordered by the Army are not yet in, and thus it would not be legal, for them to move forward. So all of that is going to play out. The fight goes on, in other words, but it's worth noting that first with the executive order supporting these pipelines, now with these actions by the Army, that the Trump administration is going to go out of their way to help all the pipelines that anyone wants to build, make it. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined as we continue our conversation by Jasmine Jefferson, who's the legislative director at Social Security Works, and Grant Farowich, who is a Sputnik News analyst here at Sputnik News. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Eugene.
Of course. And so lots happening today in terms of confirmations and the like. Republicans made a big show of ramming through the committee vote on Steve Mnuchin and Tom Price for Treasury and Health and Human Services, respectively. Woo, struggling a little bit here. That's what happens to you with this Trump administration. So much happening. It's hard to stay focused. But I wanted to start here, Jasmine, with almost more of a framing question. I mean, seeing how, you know, the Democrats have put out this boycott and the Republicans just changed the rules. I mean, it just sort of seems like they almost, Republicans, have like a by any means necessary of how they're going to push these people through and are much more willing than Republicans to kind of get down and dirty on these confirmation fights. I mean, the Democrats.
Yeah. The Republicans have been consistent, as we saw. They're just following through what they did with the Obama administration, right? So they were obstructions there. They said, we're not going to put up a SCOTUS nominee for 9 months. Now we're just following through, seeing their extreme policies to say, by any means necessary, we're going to have our way, regardless of if it's good for the American people, regardless of if it's fair even to the Democratic Party. So once the Democrats decided not to show up and not to boycott yesterday for these two votes, You think they would have had a conversation, because the Democrats had a list of demands. They wanted more information, which is completely relevant to these two nominees who have very, very in-depth ethical concerns that the American people should be concerned about. And so we should have had more information there, but that's not how the Republicans want to work. They are down and dirty and ready to do, like you said, by any means necessary, they're going to get their nominees through.
Mm-hmm. Grant Farowich, I want your thoughts on this. Former First Lady Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high. Seems the Republicans are going low and the Democrats are just doing very little.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for the Dems, I'd like to see them go a little bit stronger and push back, especially, I think, on the DeVos nomination. But from one standpoint, I think that the Trump White House is very much kind of doing away with sort of our original, like, constitutional and legal precedents. And I think this stems from the fact that Trump has never held a position in office, never been a mayor, never been a governor. And so he's used to working in the private sector, right? And sort of that can be a very top-down kind of institution. And so from Trump's management style, I don't even know if it's a governing style as much as it's a management style, that he's got his cabinet. He said, yeah, people are saying it's the most talented cabinet ever, all this stuff. And he really wants to get it through, right? I mean, and any president would. But I think that by any means necessary for Trump is sort of like a no-brainer. Mm. Insofar as, you know, this guy, he sees that, okay, I've got a movement, the people elected me, and so I should have my picks. And I think that there is, I think I heard something that Trump is advocating for deploying the nuclear option. I don't know if you guys heard this.
Yeah, no, for sure. Go ahead, Jasmine. I think that's a huge issue.
I heard the same thing. So there are particular nominees that only require 51 votes. And then the Supreme Court nominee currently requires 60 votes. And that's been the precedent that was set by the previous Congress. And Donald Trump has made it clear today that he would allow for Mitch McConnell to instead allow the 51 votes for the Supreme Court nominee if that's what it takes to get it through.
Right. But I've also heard that this could set up the Republican Senate for kind of difficulties down the road, right? Because then presumably in the future, like if we have a Democratic president and say like a Democratic Senate, then Mitch McConnell's in big trouble. So I don't think Mitch McConnell wants to use the nuclear option. I mean, some of the Republican aides I've talked to on the Hill have confirmed that.
Yeah, no, I think that it's an interesting point. You know, I once heard years ago John Kerry speak at something, and it was during the Bush administration, and someone said, well, are you going to do X, Y, and Z to roll back all of the power that Bush has aggregated to himself in the executive? And John Kerry said, well, we think we're going to win the next election, so no, because we want to use the exact same stuff. And so you sort of see like you're really playing with fire with these sort of procedural rules, because who knows who the person's going to be. And, you know, Jasmine, I'm curious too, as someone who works as a legislative director, I mean, how tricky is it sort of navigating the what's next in this Trump administration, where, you know, some of these people, including Trump or Mnuchin, have no political record. Some of them have like a far right political record that seems to even go against some of what Trump said during the campaign. I mean, how difficult can it be to kind of get through this thicket? And is this maybe something of a strategy here to kind of keep his opponents confused early on?
Yeah, I think just the divide between the Republicans in general, like you mentioned, Donald Trump is not your typical politician. As a matter of fact, he's not a politician at all until today, or until, I guess, January 20th. He wasn't a politician. And then So moving forward, I guess, as a legislative director, I think it's a challenge because we don't know what to expect from him. He's made certain promises and some of those promises he's kept. But as we just talked about, there are several promises that he could potentially not keep because of the other people that he's putting in his circle. So with Social Security and Medicare, for example, he says he wants to protect Social Security. He wants to protect Medicare. That's what he said on his campaign. But then he nominates someone like Representative Tom Price, who has made it very clear that he doesn't support Medicare. He doesn't support Social Security. So it's confusing. We always keep our eyes open for signals or who he surrounds himself with because there are people around him making important decisions. And that's what I think is key here, the people around him.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's good. That's key. I mean, Grant, I'm curious what you think about the same issue.
Yeah, if I could hop in. I think with Price, like, I'm curious, is he really going to be very legislative or is he going to be, you know, because now he's tasked with overseeing a government agency. I almost wonder, like, okay, aren't his roles and responsibilities within HHS, shouldn't that take precedence over formulating legislation, which is what lawmakers do, not the executive branch, ideally, right? But obviously, there's a lot of bleed over there. I think with regards to whether Price is really going to cut back on some of like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, I think it's going to be really tough because say it went through the House, you have a lot of senators that are from sort of like reddish, bluish states that they're facing re-election. And I know, like, for instance, a number of Republicans spoke out about repealing the part of the Affordable Care Act that expands the Medicaid program. And actually, interestingly enough, the Health Human Secretary Chair or Director in Indiana actually just requested, obviously Mike Pence's home state, just requested a 3-year extension of their Medicaid program. So it's one of these things, like, once people have government cookies, like, more or less, like, it's very politically tough to take those away without, you know, really putting yourself in a tough position for your reelection chances.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you give, what, 11 million poor people who never had access to healthcare, and then you think, like, oh my God, like, there's no way I can walk this back. Ohio, obviously, is one of those states that's extended. I think Arkansas is one of those more Republican states that extended. And so there's a bunch of these states that are out there. And I think, you know, we got about 30 seconds before we go to break, and I want to come back on this. But this is something I think that's super important, Jasmine. Social Security and Medicare are two of the most popular programs in the country.
Oh, yeah. The most popular, it's bipartisan. Everyone supports Social Security and Medicare, and they did not vote for those programs to be cut.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is 100% correct. So we want to get into the weeds on all of that after a break that we have coming up here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, some of what's happening on the Hill in terms of nominations of certain people and what that could mean, some of the contradictions between Republicans and Republicans, Democrats and Republicans. A lot to say about all of these actually quite popular programs that could still somehow end up on the chopping block. And we continue to be joined by Jasmine Jefferson, who's the legislative director for Social Security Works, and Grant Farowich, who's a Sputnik News analyst. And Jasmine, I just want to come in on this. I mean, it's often said, or it used to be said all the time, Social Security is the third rail of American politics. So for those who don't understand, third rail in electric trains, that's the electric one. You don't touch the third rail. So no one wanted to touch the third rail. Bush, for instance, tried to do something and got, like, destroyed when it became clear. Trump just steered clear of it during the campaign. But it does seem, I mean, Republicans with both houses of Congress are people who have hated these programs, want to gut them. So, I mean, there's no real chance, is there, that over the next 4 years, this isn't going to come up.
It has to come up. Paul Ryan, for one, is probably one of the biggest enemies of both all the programs you named, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He has had introduced budgets in the past that have had cuts to all of those programs. All of the past budgets that Tom Price introduced had cuts to those programs, and so the Republicans on the House have been very consistent. We saw Representative Sam Johnson introduce a bill at the end of last Congress that appeared to be something that was comprehensive and would reform Social Security, but in reality, we could do nothing and have a better plan than what he gave us. So coming up in this Congress, I would be very surprised if something didn't come up. But the Democrats really have to stay strong on this one and in caucus together and say that they're not going to stand for any cut.
Well, Grant, I'm curious what you think of it. Is that even possible? I mean, you'd think yes, but I mean, it seems like some of these Democrats, like, I mean, it seems almost like Joe Manchin is like the Democratic mouthpiece for the Trump administration and the way he's playing it out. So, I mean, it seems like if the Republicans were to go for some sort of attack, they might be able to break some Democrats off, but maybe not.
I actually think this is like a great little marketing tactic that the Republicans have, that they say that they're against like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. If we look at George's Bush record, George W. I mean, Medicare Part D was totally unfunded, was a massive expansion.
I mean,
this had Republicans like real, like kind of like hardcore conservatives or self-ascribed. I mean, they were up in arms. They thought they voted for a fiscally conservative president. And I mean, really, since the 80s, we haven't had a consistently fiscally conservative president. If you look at budgets and deficits and adding the national debt, everyone loves to praise Reagan, and we saw the national debt skyrocket under Reagan. You can't cut taxes and increase military spending and not have like huge budget problems. So this started, ironically enough, under a so-called fiscally conservative president. So I think it's a great little marketing line that the Republicans tout, that they advocate small government and all these things. I mean, it gets people on board. It gets people to vote. And sure enough, people do vote. People vote for out of the Republican Party way more than out of the Dem Party, which is a huge problem for the Dems, is not getting people out to vote. But sorry if that got off track a little bit there, Eugene. In terms of gutting Social Security, I mean, I know Paul Ryan like wants to do pushbacks and stuff like this. And I think he's probably the biggest champion, and Mitch McConnell too, right? But that's the thing, is that I mean, I think Trump is going to continue sort of like PR games, because he's said, you know, I'm going to make sure that there's no person on the street that doesn't have access to healthcare. I mean, he said that very loud and clear.
Well, he's saying, I'm going to like eliminate the Affordable Care Act, which everyone says could get rid of 18 million people.
Oh, there's absolutely no, I would love, President Obama said this, I would love to see them try to roll back the Affordable Care Act. This was a Heritage Foundation idea from 1993. This is a right-wing idea. It is the individual market. Mm-hmm. What are you going to replace it with? They've been running this PR campaign, and it's just that. It's an attack on Obama, and that's all it ever was. Mm-hmm. I mean, frankly, I've been appalled. I mean, and if you listen to analysts, like people that analysts from Wall Street, for example, there's an event at Brookings right after the election, and they were talking about the Affordable Care Act, because all the insurers that are providing these plans are going, you know, what the heck's going to happen? And insurance lobby, from my understanding, this might have changed, but they are not willing to jump on the Trump train and denouncing the Affordable Care Act, because they've just put all this money into compliance regulations.
Right.
Like, they've already sunk a ton of money.
And so it's
like, now you're going to throw new regulations on us?
I mean, it's going to be interesting. And we can see that Republicans in their own thing didn't do it. And I'm glad you brought up the PR issue. And I have to plug here a great article from 2004, my man, historian Robin Blackburn, How Monica Lewinsky Saved Social Security. That's all I'm going to say. Go read that article. It's a fantastic article about how Clinton did a reverse turn on, because he was actually preparing the way for Social Security private accounts and privatization. Then he got caught in a little scandal. Next thing you know, we're going to take Social Security and put it in a lockbox, which, fantastic slogan, PR slogan back then. And Clinton was great at that. But let me also ask you this, Jasmine. I mean, The one thing that I think for Social Security that I always like to establish in these conversations is the kind of the whole basis for either raising the retirement age or, you know, reducing benefits or means testing them or whatever, is that Social Security is broke, that it has no money. But I mean, to some degree, I mean, one, I don't, that's not true. But B, even if it was true, it's like an enforced starvation on Social Security, because when the payroll taxes are out, if you're like a billionaire, once you reach a certain cap, you don't pay any more money. So if you had like the super rich actually continuing to pay, you wouldn't really have an issue.
Yeah, there are a lot of perpetuated lies about Social Security, including that it's going broke. And we know that's not true. Social Security has a surplus right now. And so the American people are a lot misinformed on Social Security. But like you said, there are several things that you can do. So we could do something, like you said, lift the cap or completely eliminate the cap altogether so that millionaires and billionaires are paying their fair share. The great thing about Social Security is that it's universal. So it's not a means-tested program. It's not something just for poor people. It's an earned benefit. It's something that everyone pays into. And if you pay into it, then you get back what you put into it. And it's so unique. It's so special. It's so efficient and effective. SSA does a great job to making sure there's no fraud. They have a less than 1% fraud rate. So that's another perpetuated lie.
I think we've had like big players like Warren Buffett and George Soros kind of speak out about this. I would love to see them kind of throw their hat in the ring on Social Security particularly. I know Warren Buffett has, he's like, yeah, I pay a lower effective tax rate than my secretary. I mean, all this buku stuff.
I really wish the Social Security tax was not called FICA. I don't think anyone, I feel like people get the most upset about FICA. There's that fantastic Chris Rock, too many expletives for me to say it, excerpt on FICA. But I feel like, oh, what is this FICA? They're taking all my money. I think people would be happy if they knew that's what it really was. And it just speaks to sort of the misinformation that's out there. And, you know, just sort of swinging on that, I don't know if this is misinformation, but just sort of a difficult. So, I mean, how are you parsing Trump's administration on this? I mean, he said, I don't want to touch these two things. But, I mean, Tom Price, who we've already talked about a little bit, feel free to say more about him. But, I mean, even more than that, Mick Mulvaney at the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, who is like the cutter of all cutters of everything in the budget, including Social Security and Medicare. The most extreme to some degree in the Republican Congress was the Freedom Caucus guy. And so it just sort of seems like of the people who we can predict, it's like hardcore opponents of these programs. But then obviously Trump, you know, allegedly controls them and seems to be on the opposite page. So I don't know how you're, I mean, are you just, I don't know. You tell me.
What I'm doing is listening very closely to Mick Mulvaney. Mm. I don't know if you all heard his hearing. He had two hearings in the Budget Committee and then as well as the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee in the Senate. And what he said very clearly was that he would convince Donald Trump to go back on his promise, if necessary, to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or any other program. Mm. So I think that his intentions are to go into the White House, be in the position of the Director of Office Management and Budget, and convince Donald Trump that he should be able to cut those programs. You have to make it seem like it's not optional, like you don't have any other way to do what you want to do. And so the American people need to watch out for someone like Mick Mulvaney.
Well, let me ask you a quick follow-up, too, which I think is relevant to this, because, you know, the big thing with Social Security that people say is, well, we're going to create these individual retirement accounts. Now, there's a guy, I won't go too deep into this, but he was an advisor of Hillary Clinton. He's a big Wall Street banker. And he was pushing sort of a Democratic version of this, where you don't eliminate Social Security, but you add the private accounts sort of like alongside of it to make it a part of it. And it just sort of seems like that's also a particular risk, because say you're a Democrat and you feel like, oh, you know, I get all this money from Wall Street, and as long as they don't get rid of Social Security, who really cares if they create these independent retirement accounts or whatever? That's an IRA, but something like an IRA for every person. But it also seems like that could be a real dangerous slippery slope.
All that is undermining the people's confidence in the program. It's making people feel like, well, just in case Social Security won't be here, let me make sure that I put my own money away. But again, we've been told over and over again, Social Security is strong. Social Security is going to be here for us. Social Security isn't something that I need to worry about, because even if we paid nothing else into the Social Security trust funds, you would get 75% of your benefit after 2033. So it's just completely unfounded to think that we should have some sort of private accounts alongside Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think this is sort of one of the things that the Republicans in the House always bring up when they talk about ACA reform is these HSAs, health savings accounts. And there are investment vehicles that disproportionately favor people that are already wealthy and don't really help the people that these programs are designed to help the most.
Right.
So it's kind of, I guess I see it as sort of like a little loophole for the people that are wealthy to kind of get theirs when there is potential reforms.
Mm-hmm. No, well, it certainly speaks to sort of the trickiness of how people who want to eliminate Social Security, I mean, they've been trying to do this for a long time, and like this a million different ways, they're coming at you so many different ways. I mean, I'm curious, what are some of the main interest groups that want to get rid of Medicare, want to get rid of Social Security? I mean, it just sort of seems like a strange thing to be like, oh, yeah, let's get rid of that. I mean, I don't know, helping old people who can no longer work.
I think it's this ideologue that like they want to push this narrative of individual responsibility and, you know, you shouldn't lean on the government. And I think it's a PR thing, because I don't think I'm going to be stunned. I really will. If we have substantive cuts to Medicaid, I shouldn't say it. Medicaid, I see probably the biggest.
Yeah, because people think it only helps black people.
There. Yeah,
which
there.
Is totally awful. I mean, I think actually it's single white mothers that are the number one recipients of Medicare
just
funds.
Just like almost all welfare programs, and certainly affirmative action.
And that's,
for sure.
That's another terrible narrative that's been around since Reagan that just gets mm-hmm. perpetuated. Mm-hmm. And
Jasmine, who are you lobbying against?
Who am I lobbying against? Good question. I feel bad for calling out people when we're lobbying against them. But there's always those groups. So, if, for example, the Heritage Budget example is one that they're supposedly using in the Trump administration right now. And that budget has been reviewed. And the Center for Budget Priorities just put out a really good paper on what that budget would do. They would absolutely cut Social Security and Medicare and all kinds of other things in their budget. And so if this is the template that the Trump administration is using, then we have reason to be worried.
Mm-hmm. No, that's for sure. Well, let me ask you both this, and Jasmine, I'll start with you. I mean, it seems like there may be a sort of a weird silver lining here. So John Conyers, I believe next week, is getting ready to introduce his H.R. 676, the Medicare for All bill, single-payer health care bill. Nancy Pelosi, she won't commit to signing on to that bill, but she has been running around saying, I support universal health care. And I mean, we were talking on this show a few weeks back that I thought that would be a nice move for the Democrats to say, like, okay, if you get rid of the Affordable Care Act, the only thing we will accept is if every person has access to Medicare, which is a great system, which everyone loves, which is highly rated. And that maybe in a weird silver lining sort of way, this whole debate over the ACA could maybe even renew Medicare in a bigger way, because it's so popular. Even 41% of Republicans support universal health care, so that might sort of turn against the Republicans in a strange way like that.
Yeah, I think it would be an awesome plan moving forward. I know something that we're looking into is to see what sorts of plans that the Democrats can get behind that vary between like lowering the Medicare age slowly or just eliminating it altogether and saying we're going to make sure that everyone has health care in the form of Medicare. Like you said, Medicare for all. And so I think it's an awesome plan. I think that the Democrats should definitely look into doing something like this, because if the Republicans are going to go far one way, the Democrats have to come stand behind something really strong.
Grant.
I love this. This is like one of my favorite policy spiels, is that from an economic standpoint, right, we have a current healthcare system that is roughly 20% of our GDP, around $3 trillion. And it's often very expensive for not necessarily better health outcomes. Spend the highest GDP per capita in the world on healthcare. And we do not, definitively do not have the longest life expectancy, which isn't, you know, maybe the only rating or measure you'd want to look at, but it's certainly an indicative one. And so one of the things is I used to do kind of healthcare journalism. And so you talk to insurers, payers, and they say, well, yeah, like we have to charge really high rates to consumers because hospitals charge us so much. And then you talk to hospitals, healthcare systems, and they say, well, you know, we're ordering all these services and charging $37.50 for one Tylenol.
Wow.
We're doing this because we're worried about medical malpractice. Mm. And so it's sort of this circle, because then they're like, oh, well, like, yeah, it's the tort lawyers that put the doctors in this tough position. So essentially, like, if we really want to get serious about looking at how to contain the cost growth, which was really one of the Obama administration's like greatest achievements that they touted, was that not even that they reduced costs of healthcare to the economy as a whole, but that they reduced the cost growth. And so if we look at Medicare, we get much lower rates on a lot of different services that if we can negotiate with providers from one payer standpoint, you can bring costs down a lot. Like, you get a ton of leverage. This is how NHS does it.
No, for sure. Well, and also the Canada, where the national health insurance is called Medicare, and believe it or not, insurance companies and pharmaceuticals are actually launching a big attack on Canadian healthcare right now. So if you're listening to this and you're in Canada, you may want to check on that because your healthcare system is under attack. I mean, I think that an interesting question to me, too, that I think is related to something that Grant mentioned with Tom Price, especially, Jasmine, is – you know, when you're in HHS, I almost wonder if the biggest threat from him isn't the big sweeping stuff, but the kind of death by a thousand cuts since he controls the administration of it.
Yeah, there's something really unique that he will do that a lot of people don't know about. He'll be a trustee for Medicare trust funds. He'll be a trustee. And that trustee is supposed to be a watchdog. That trustee is supposed to put out a report along with several other secretaries to talk about the health of Medicare, for example. When you're in that sort of position, you can make assumptions. You can change assumptions. You can write a report that would make Congress think that Medicare is in a lot more trouble than it would than you would normally hear just because you put out this report. And so, like you said, it's not really the sweeping legislation, maybe, but it's small stuff like that, like changing assumptions and reports and all that kind of stuff, giving advice to the president, all of those things that are going to be crucial.
It reminds me of a story. The trustee thing. You know, in a lot of states, they have trustees in prison, which are basically like, you know, you're favored by the administration. They let you do stuff, leave or whatever. I think it was Mississippi in like the 80s. A guy escaped from prison and he was a trustee. And the governor said, well, if you can't trust a trustee, who can you trust? And this seems like that kind of situation. And it seems like kind of the MO, Grant, of the Trump administration overall is to create like these fake, you know, the alternative facts to make people want to do one thing or another.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the death by a thousand cuts, I think this by talking about how much Obamacare is failing, I mean, they've been doing this like for a couple of months now. So we had open enrollment that just ended yesterday. And so every time that they talked about how Obamacare is failing, like that's a negative advertisement for people to go sign up. And this freaks out insurers. This freaks out. I mean, it's like the death by a thousand cuts has already happened because now it's going to happen. Say the enrollment goes down, they're going to like touted even more. But it's like, you know, we should be promoting this and saying like, hey guys, here's exactly how you do it. Here's exactly how you get signed up and really facilitating this. So like even like a slight against the Affordable Care Act open exchanges that already is, you know, chipping away at the Affordable Care Act, which is really, it's terrible, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's a very good point. I think that certainly it's sort of the connection between the Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, I think is so important because it really forms sort of like the 20th century idea of how sort of people's fundamental rights should be expanded. I mean, it's certainly not in the Constitution, but the idea that like if you can no longer work, people should help you. If you need help paying for health care, you shouldn't not have health care and things like that. And I mean, it seems like it's really part of a broader, much more significant philosophical conversation here that's being pushed on us by the far right in this country, by the people who want to push free markets above everything else, no matter what, in order to do it. But nevertheless, I think that's where we're going to have to stop it here today. But thank you both so much we're going to have one more segment, stop this segment, I should say, here today. Thank you both so much for joining. We're going to be back with a couple more guests here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a buzzword that's in the air, at least on the progressive side of things, is this concept of resistance cities. So talking about how we can use our local and hyper-local, perhaps, organizing efforts to move this resistance forward here is our topic for today, and we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Eve Brotman, who's an assistant professor of environmental studies at Franklin and Marshall College, and Joel Rothschild, who's the founding organizer of Eco Villagers Alliance. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thanks, Eugene.
Thank you, Eugene.
Of course. So I wanted to start here, and maybe I don't know if this is sort of a framing question, but seeing a lot of what you guys are doing with eco-villagers and some of the concepts, and certainly from my own experience working in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, chatting with folks from Occupy Sandy, doing things around co-ops and development and the like in D.C., I mean, it seems like in and of itself – sort of building resilient communities in the context of where we are right now is a resistance strategy, not like because, you know, whatever, people are withdrawing from politics or anything, but we need more stable bases and modeling, I think, for how people could be living if we really want to try to have like a counter vision to what Trump is putting out. Eve, I'll start with you, but your general comments on that.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of building alternative ways of owning property and cooperating together is, I think, one of the fundamentals of our model in Eco-Villagers Alliance and is part of what it takes to have a more strong base of progressive organizing more generally, because it's about creating new interdependencies that are connecting people together over issues that they care about. And that starts with the home. That starts with our localities. And when people talk about the importance of all politics being local, to us in this initiative, a lot of what that means is really putting forth some actions and creating some spaces where that local engagement and investment and building our dreams so that they come true becomes part of our everyday effort.
Perfect. Joel, go ahead.
We were talking about this last night coming home from a march. You said, you know, the left is really good at resistance. What we're not good at is resilience. And we used to be much stronger in this regard because there were spaces like those Eve's describing us trying to recreate now, Grange halls, union halls, churches that, you know, were really strong and not, you know, slowly dying by attrition. And those spaces provided a regular platform for organizing over the long run instead of just responding to evil events when they come down the pike. It's important to resist evil events when they come down the pike, and we're so much stronger when we have been building through very regular relationship forming and daily engagement or weekly engagement, and that really requires the maintenance of spaces that hold that resilience activity.
Well, I think those are very good points. And let me ask you another sort of relevant question, I think, for understanding a lot of the way you guys are framing what you're doing. You know, over the sort of, well, I don't even know if it was a confirmation hearing, but whatever they were doing with Ben Carson, the sort of the patty cake they were doing, one of the issues that came up was this issue of ownership. And obviously, as our listeners may not know, Republicans, this is always a big deal. They always say that the government shouldn't back the mortgage market. Democrats say that they should because that's like the American dream or whatever. Interestingly enough, I tend to sort of come down more on the side philosophically of where the Republicans are, that to some degree, this whole idea of like quote unquote ownership, the way it's put in the American context, not only is it based on sort of an unsustainable reality, but it's also based on, you know, a model that was also rooted in racism. So it doesn't really work in a lot of ways. And so much money goes towards subsidizing a handful of relatively houses in the suburbs as opposed to providing housing. But be that as it may, you know, one of the pieces with co-ops, both in employment and in housing and different pieces, is it looks at ownership in a different way. It kind of turns it on its head. So I was wondering, Joel, if initially you could give us some thoughts about how you guys are kind of flipping this concept that we hear a lot about in our society in a different way.
Well, I would say that the neoliberal model of home ownership turns millennia of human relationship to our habitat on its head. And we're just trying to get back to something that makes sense and is actually sustainable. I think any homeowner who has fulfilled the American dream as we know it and has a mortgage understands that they don't actually own their home. The bank does. I think any homeowner who has managed to escape that dynamic and own free and clear still understands that there's something missing in the relationship to our habitat. Every time, I don't know, a neighbor's tree drops a limb in the backyard and it turns into a big fight over trivia, while at the same time there's this slow degradation of the entire environment around us, which we want to give to our children and grandchildren. So I think it's fairly clear that not just to folks in any particular point in the political spectrum, but across the board, that something about the mortgage services and financial products dominated model that we have been using for the last century has really reached the limits of its capacity to serve us, humans, our families, our communities in relation to our habitat.
Very, very interesting point. And I think an interesting way to connect sort of the climate justice piece to our own history. But Eve, let me ask you this, because I think, you know, talking about sustainability, and certainly if you want to say something about ownership, feel free to say that as well. In fact, maybe I'll just give you a chance. If there's something you want to jump in with there, go ahead.
I was interested as you were framing that question around the idea of racism being pretty embedded within our private ownership system. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Jessica Gordon Nemhart's fabulous book on the history of Black cooperative organizing and economic solidarity efforts. It's called Collective Courage. And that book for us is one of the inspirations that leads us to think about cooperatives as a mechanism through which we can undo some of the historical injustices within our economic system. It's through cooperative ownership that people find new models of solidarity and through which we stabilize some of the highly speculative markets that end up putting many people's homes and livelihoods at risk because of the way that our banking system has been constructed.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very great point. That's a fantastic book. Definitely shout out to Jessica. I saw her a few days ago. Organizing for Neighborhood Equity, D.C. I'll shout them out, too. She's a board member there, and it's certainly her book is having a huge impact, Cooperation Jackson, which she helped start as well. So a lot of stuff going on, spokes in the wheel there, connecting those issues. And let me also follow up with you on this, Eve, too, which I think is very relevant, because I think when we're talking about housing and how we're using land and how we're living, one of the issues that I feel like doesn't get enough play in the sustainability discussion in America, not that no one's talking about it, but I don't think it gets enough play, is food security issues. And in fact, quite frankly, the conversation around hunger and sustainability are really two separate policy conversations right now. But then I look around the world, you know, in Havana, like 80% of the fruits and vegetables people are eating grown in Havana. Shanghai is pretty up there. Karachi in Pakistan also up there. So, I mean, around the world, it's becoming a more mainstream idea that we can grow more of our own food kind of right where we live. And it has a huge impact on sustainability. I mean, it seems like it's kind of a blind spot in some of the conversations we're having now in America, but it seems to me at least to be something that's important to scale. But I wonder your thoughts on that.
It's certainly important to scale. I would argue that it's less of a blind spot these days with the rise of so much attention to local food systems within at least a certain sort of elite sector of urban environmentalists that want to do the right thing and shop at farmers markets and eat at restaurants that have connections to local farmers and so on, which is certainly a growing sector of our food economy. But where we've got some gaps and where that could still really be improved is in actual urban food growing. A lot of the local, supposedly local farm-to-fork restaurants and even farmers markets are actually still sourcing from well over 100 miles away when in fact we could do a lot more to use underutilized urban spaces as sources of food. And that's everything from community gardens to growing food on rooftops. And at the same time as that would be able to create new sources of food production hyper-locally would also do quite a lot to address everything from urban blight issues to stormwater runoff and water management issues in more sustainable ways. So certainly thinking about urban food systems and integrating into our commercial as well as our residential lives, the idea of having more productive landscapes and productive in the sense of food plus other sorts of benefits like aesthetic beauty and stormwater runoff mitigation and so on is an important part of how we can make our cities more green and sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Good. You know, that's a good point. And it makes me think of something else too, Joel, that I think is relevant. I mean, I know what you guys are doing in Eco Villagers, talking a lot about how to build sort of not just sort of local, but regional kind of alliances of people in terms of sort of starting to reach this level of scale. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit too, because I think so often because of, you know, what I view as a somewhat ridiculous way we sort of set up states and cities, like here, you guys are in Pennsylvania, I'm in Washington, D.C. We're relatively close to each other in some ways. Lancaster, I think, is where you guys are. But it's like all these different jurisdictions. You got Maryland, Pennsylvania, D.C., state, local, da-da-da-da. We never really think across these lines in a big way, even though a lot of times the similarities sort of biologically are very similar in terms of the regions.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, one of the challenges we face in the eco-village organizing world is trying to find appropriate scopes for our engagement. So clearly there are local neighborhoods. We can relate to those through our relationships with our neighbors, with our bodies' relationships to our immediate environment in ways that feel pretty intuitive. But then when you get beyond that, we start talking about bioregions and ecosystems, and it can get harder to relate to, and yet very, very critical for us to understand how we are interconnected on those levels. And it's true, the jurisdictional lines in this country and in much of the world were drawn by 18th, 19th century colonialists without a lot of understanding for or appreciation for many of the interconnections that ultimately would sustain the people. And you can draw your own political conclusions from there. Certainly, it's something we look at, but it's going to be a long process of reorienting our culture and the ways in which we organize and allocate resources around the true flows of interconnection between us.
Well, and I'm really glad you brought up the issue of the way that you organize, because I think, Eve, one thing that I thought was interesting about the eco-villagers model was a strong, and you are a college professor, a professional, a strong focus on building volunteer networks of people with certain types of expertise and things of that nature, which I liked it. I thought it was interesting because now I think we sort of exist in a world where so much, you know, quote-unquote progressive or left-wing organizing or whatever is so privileged towards nonprofits with large staffs funded by foundations. I think, you know, I'm only 30, but, you know, most people I meet who are younger than me who are thinking about organizing, their whole concept is, oh, well, I got to go find a job with one of these nonprofits. I mean, it really has become sort of a hegemonic way of looking at things. And it seems like you guys are going for one that's, you know, less, not only less overhead heavy, but more focused on sort of building collectivity in the work as in and of itself. So I was hoping you could speak a little to that as well.
Sure. I'll begin. I'm sure Joel will want to chime in here too, but a lot of how we're approaching this work is that this is our activism, and it takes the form of volunteer labor, at least at present. But one of the really important things about doing this sort of engagement is that it is essentially a community investment. It's investing in each other, and it's thinking at a scale of what would be possible in my neighborhood or in a bunch of small cities up and down the mid-Atlantic seaboard that we tend to ignore when the urban conversation is so often centered around world cities or mega cities like New York or Washington, D.C. or Philadelphia. And so, you know, we're looking to focus at the neighborhood scale and through engaging within the alliance in these sorts of collaborative relationships. I think we're all, I can speak for the group here to say that it's enormously satisfying as a way of channeling volunteer effort that is actually building something together. It's, you know, well beyond the sort of put a Band-Aid on the problem by planting trees or working at soup kitchens. Nothing against those forms of activism, but what we're doing through this sort of labor together is constructing a totally other model so that we address some of the longstanding issues of inequality, poverty, and environmental degradation.
Mm-hmm. No, great point. As someone from a small mid-Atlantic city, I feel your pain, although I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia, so more people know a little bit about that for the wrong reasons, because many slave owners are from there who also founded this country. But nevertheless, I definitely hear you. Although, shout out Lancaster, PA, the outlets there, I know about you. Good place, great small city.
So can we make a shout out not just for the outlet malls, but also for the massive refugee resettlement program that's been ongoing in Lancaster for decades?
That's actually really interesting because, you know, Charlottesville, where I'm from, is a big refugee spot too. Tell me about that, because I think in this context, a lot of people don't know about that kind of stuff.
Well, I think I think everyone should take a look at. Just, you know, trot over to your local Google and, you know, and enter Lancaster refugee resettlement. You'll find a lot of information you may not expect from largely the local Mennonite community, who have been so unpatriotic as to serve their fellow man without prejudice along national lines.
Mm, yes. No, I think that's very important. And I'm pretty sure they also do a pretty good job of civil disobedience to militarism as well and participate very fully in the Charlottesville farmers market. We're just shouting out all good things. But I do want to give you a chance, Joel, to talk on this issue about kind of the organizing model that you guys are putting in place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that you framed it in terms of what my colleagues for many, many years as a professional, and I came somewhat cynically to refer to as the charity industrial complex, which takes so many of us who work very hard to acquire professional skills in order to apply them toward the production of good in the world, and then get sucked into these neoliberal systems that wind up reproducing the bad. And it's exceedingly frustrating for many people, very good people who work in the nonprofit sector. And so when we began many years ago now, in fact, in D.C., the Eco-Villagers Alliance is a project that grew out of work done by activists and organizers in D.C. And is now regional to the Mid-Atlantic as a whole. When we began this work, there emerged a real collective desire to get off that carousel and to create a different way of organizing and working and allocating resources together that would tend to really bring the people into possession of the most important assets governing our lives, and that the consultancy and charitable nonprofit models weren't serving that desire. And we tried for many, many years, decades, arguably centuries, and it's clearly not working. So instead of continuing to beat a dead horse, we decided to try to move in a new direction. But what would that be? And so we arrived at cooperativism. And since we're doing shout-outs and already mentioned Dr. Nembhard, I would let your D.C. Audience know that she will be speaking on a panel hosted at the National Press Club by the National Cooperative Business Association on Monday, February 13th at 3:30. And it's free, so everyone should go. The benefit of cooperativism over the traditional American nonprofit model is that it's not about profit or not profit. It's about service.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today, but I appreciate you guys. We'll definitely bring you back, talk more about this on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik. That's going to do it for our show today. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.